breath quite clearly. I see images appearing in the background, some of which are real, others are imaginary. They appear and pass away. How should I deal with this? Okay, so here it's like almost like you have a double awareness. Yeah, you can see both the breath and you can hear images. And this is quite common. Yeah, I mean, a lot of the time there are many things happening at the same time in meditation practice. Sometimes you watch the breath. You can also hear things around you. You can watch the breath and think a little bit in between sometimes, thoughts coming and going. Things tend to be jumbled up a little bit. You know, obviously we can feel pleasure and also watch the breath. That's very obvious once meditation starts to work. So what you have to do in this particular case is really just to allow the images to be there. It doesn't matter. Yeah, these things are there. They're just like everything else. They arise and they pass away. And your main thing for you to do is just to allow the awareness to rest on the breath. And as you do that, eventually those images will just pass away by themselves. There's nothing you really have to do with them. If they get too interesting, that's when the problem arises. Then you start watching the images, you forget about the breath. So keep your attention on the breath. Find out the pleasure of just being with the breath, and then these things will eventually disappear. That is recommended. It often gets very interesting in meditation practice, especially when the mind gets a lot of clarity. Many people have lots of experiences with all kinds of visions appearing. And sometimes it's good fun to kind of just play around a little bit with those visions and see what happens. Because sometimes, you know, you're in territory you've never been before. It's just fun to kind of mess around with that a little bit. So that's okay. It's okay to have a bit of playtime, right? You shouldn't take life too seriously. It's one of the great things about the monastery with someone like Ajahn Brahm. He always likes to mess around. I'm sure you know what I mean. Tell terrible jokes sometimes, and everybody still laughs, right? So, which is great. So you mess around a little bit. Don't take life too seriously, because that gives a lightness of being, a lightness of things. Same thing with meditation. You play around a little bit. Enjoy yourself a little bit. Don't take it too seriously. And when you have that internal lightness, it transfers into kind of a positive experience, extra, you know, within your whole being, basically. Eventually, you let go of that imagery as well. You go back to the breath again, and then you just stay with the breath and continue into all the super-duper state that you get from breath meditation. Okay, so let's see what the next one is. Dear Ajahn, happy birthday. It's actually tomorrow. Is everyone aware of that? You sang very beautifully today in the dining hall, but it's actually tomorrow. That's okay. That's perfectly fine. Dear Ajahn, happy birthday. Thank you very much. How does a monk usually celebrate such an auspicious day? Are you sure it's auspicious? You know, I'm getting pretty old now. Sometimes I wonder whether it's auspicious or inauspicious. Actually, it's pretty, I would say it's pretty neutral, but usually birth in Buddhism is not a very good thing. Yeah, birth, coming back into existence again. That famous story of a newspaper in the US, I'm not sure if this is true, but Ajahn Brahm claims it's true, but I'm not entirely convinced. But according to this story, there was a newspaper somewhere in the US, and there's a baby had just been born. As soon as it's born, it opens its mouth and says, "Oh no, not again." So is birthday good? Maybe if birthday is good, it kind of leads to the end of birthdays, yeah? So hopefully it is one of those birthdays that leads to the end of birthdays. We shall see. So hard to know whether it's auspicious or not. Also, when will we see the return of Bhantisujato? We miss his Dhamma talks and good humor with much metta. That is uncertain, yeah? It is anicca. It is unreliable. You just don't know when he will return. I don't know. Nobody knows. Maybe he will never return. Maybe you have to let go. Yeah. Maybe I will never return. This is the last time you see me. Everything is so uncertain. So all I can say is that he is still in Taiwan doing his translation work. And he's supposed to come back to Australia maybe in March. Maybe. He may go to Sydney. Perhaps he will come to visit Perth. In other words, nobody knows what's going to happen. That's basically it. So, but quite likely he will come back here eventually, because he has so many friends over here, not least in the monastery. So quite likely that we will see him back here. We'll see what happens. And often when you have been translating all the Pit Nikaya that he has, and hopefully we'll have something interesting to say again, because often it changes your perspective on the Dhamma when you do such detailed work on the suttas, the word of the Buddha. we come back with some new inspiring ideas. That will be certainly be interesting and exciting here. That's the best I can say. So we'll see what happens. Ajahn, loving kindness meditation seems to focus on those whom one feels loving and kind towards. Can loving kindness meditation also be used to focus on those towards whom one feels anger and or resentment? Thank you. Postscript. Okay. Perhaps not. Okay. 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 I see. Okay. Fine. So the idea of loving kindness meditation is to include everyone. Yeah. But you can't really have loving kindness towards somebody you feel anger towards. And this was kind of the idea of the sutta I read out this afternoon, is the idea of how to overcome at anger in the first place. So you have to start off by overcoming the anger and resentment first of all. That is the first thing. And then when the anger is overcome, then you can move towards loving kindness meditation. Yeah, so this is the technique that we're talking about before today, understanding that people are conditioned in certain ways. People don't really want to do bad things or do bad things anyway because of the conditioning. And very often the right response is one of compassion and understanding rather than getting angry and resentful. And if you read one of the suttas I will be reading out tomorrow perhaps, I'm not sure if it's in there, but it's a sutta which is one of the suttas that is the most important ones about loving kindness, and it's called the simile of the saw, a very famous sutta, and I will read that simile out to you tomorrow. It's quite a gruesome simile, but it shows the power of metta when it's taken to the highest kind of extent. And in there, it says that if you're having trouble with somebody, somebody is difficult, you should first deal with that person. So first of all, have compassion and metta towards that person, first of all. So you deal with those people that you have anger and resentment towards first. And when that anger and resentment is dealt with, then you can have metta for the whole world and for everyone. Yeah, so you have to do these things in the right order. Metta only really arises because you see the good qualities in somebody else. When you see somebody else and you see all their wonderful qualities, that's when kind of metta comes. Metta is this idea of kindness towards somebody. Yeah, you're feeling a sense of love and care for somebody else and kindness. That's what it is. And the only way you can have kindness towards someone is to see the good qualities in them. That's where metta arises from. So when you do the metta meditation, it's always good to establish that sense of good qualities, first of all. And when you see the good qualities, then you can wish them well. Yeah, you can mean it because it comes from your heart. Okay, so I hope that makes sense. But sometimes, a lot of the time, in fact, it says here, I feel like the biggest fake. I talk the talk, but fail to walk the walk. Quick to become angry, slow to forgive, hard to let go of the conditioning. I know, but please help, sadhu, sadhu. Hardly got the conditioning, I know, but please help. Okay. You are not the fake, right? If you are here, how can you possibly be a fake? You're only fake if you're sitting on the floor here and you're not keeping your precepts and you're not doing anything that you're supposed to do. That's when you are a fake. As long as you're trying, you're not a fake. So you are, by being here, you're already sitting the sit. Yeah? So you're not really walking so much, you're sitting the sit when you're sitting here. So just remember, it takes time. One of the most difficult things with the spiritual path is to overcome our conditioning. Habits are so ingrained. It takes a long time to overcome these things. So be patient with yourself. One of the things that I have noticed is that often we make demands on other people to change and be different. But please don't do that, because if you look at yourself, you realize how hard it is to change yourself. And when you know how hard it is to change yourself, how can we demand a change in other people? So just be patient with yourself, and just use some of the very powerful advice in the suttas to guide you on the path. Hang around spiritual friends, right? One of the root causes for making progress on the path is one of the things that I have made a lot of certain sometimes. The root causes, one of the most important things is to have good spiritual friendship, Kalyanamitta, good friends on the spiritual path. So listen to Dhamma talks. Listen to things that condition you in the right way. Listen to the Buddha. Hang out with the Buddha. Yeah. How do you hang out with the Buddha? Read the suttas, read the discourses. Listen to people who have a bit more experience than you, reading them out. So you get kind of they come alive for you. It's so important to bring the sutta, the discourse of the Buddha, alive. There shouldn't be something dry and boring. They should actually bring out the meaning in a powerful way, so it has an emotional impact on you. Things that have an emotional impact are the things you're going to remember. Yeah, because, oh, yeah, it's like a good meditation experience. If you really have a lot of joy and happiness, you remember it for a long time afterwards. The same thing with the sutta. Sometimes you read something, it really talks to you in a very strong way, and you remember that. You bring it out of here, take it with you. So keep on brainwashing yourself. Yeah? Are you ready to be brainwashed? Yeah, it's good. It's good to be brainwashed. Yeah, it's great. It's really important. That's what the whole Buddhist path is about, is brainwashing. You know that? You come here, what do you think happens? You get brainwashed. This is why I'm teaching you. That's why I'm telling this is the word of the Buddha. And you think, yeah, that's really good stuff, actually. Yeah, really nice. What is that? That's brainwashing. Yeah? So the point, it is true in a certain sense. Here I'm kind of, this is the way Ajahn Brahm taught me this when I first came to Bodhidharma Monastery. What? Brainwashing? I'm out of here. I'm going back to Norway. That's where I'm originally from. I'm not having any brainwashing. But after a while, you start to realize that actually there is a point to this. Yeah? When Ajahn Brahm says something funny or whatever it is, usually there's a point behind it. And the point behind that is that we are brainwashed anyway. That is what conditioning means. Our entire upbringing, all the things that have influenced us through our lives, is brainwashing. So I always tell people, choose the right brainwashing. Yeah, this is the important thing. Choose the brainwashing that will make you happy. Don't choose the wrong brainwashing. Get the right brand of washing machine. Yeah, the right washing powder. The Buddha's washing powder. That's the suttas. Buddha's washing powder. Get that one. Whoa, you come out so clean on the other end. Yeah, so this is brainwashing here. But this is the point of this, and it's not really a joke at all, because the point of this is if the Buddha is right about his insight that there is no self, there is no essence inside of us, and we really are entirely conditioned human beings, and to me it seems like the Buddha is absolutely right about that, then actually we are brainwashed. Everything is brainwashing here. Yeah? So you really have to be careful to get the right brainwashing. So consider that carefully. And that's why it's so important to hang out with good spiritual friends. Hang out with the Buddha. Hang out with those people who have a good influence on you. Yeah, so if you come here on this retreat and you feel good afterwards, that's a good influence. If you feel more happy, more balanced, more mindful, more compassionate, more kind afterwards, great. If this retreat makes you more angry, more negative, more desiring, more craving, more deluded, more murderous, yeah, don't come back to this retreat in the future. This is how you decide whether things are working or not. Are the good qualities growing and the bad qualities going down? So make sure you get the right brainwashing here. Okay. Dear Ajahn, how are mind states built? How does mind conditioning work, cause and effect? Can you explain in detail? Thank you. In detail, okay. So, no. Mind states, conditioning is very... it's like, you know, you have parents, right? Your parents have a certain character traits. And when you hang around your parents, you become a bit like them. You know what I mean? Yeah, they always say, oh, when you're young, you try to rebel against your parents. But when you get older, you turn out exactly like your parents. That's the old saying, yeah? And there's some truth to that. You try to rebel, but the force of conditioning is so strong that actually you end up like your parents instead. That's usually often what happens. That's what conditioning means. We cannot resist all these external phenomena infiltrating us and conditioning us in a certain way. You watch the news on TV, yeah, you watch too many news on TV, and you end up really angry because the world is kind of going, you know, not always going the right way, right? So that can make you upset. That's also conditioning. So What we have to do as Buddhists, or as those who practice a spiritual path, many people don't really like to call themselves Buddhist. That's fine, not have to call yourself a Buddhist at all. But at least think of yourself as someone who's trying to develop yourself in a good way. Yeah, that's okay, I think. You don't have to call that Buddhism if you don't want to. What we try to do is to then condition ourselves in such a way that it leads to well-being. It leads to happiness. It leads to happiness for ourselves and also for others. So you have to try to reorder how you think about the world. So one of the basic things that we do that is to keep precepts, yeah? To be kind, to be caring towards ourselves and others. And if you try to be consistently kind to other people, something happens in your mind as well, because you are forced to try to see those people in a different way. You can't really be kind if you hate someone, but if you deliberately try to be kind, deliberately try to be generous, something starts to rewire inside of you and you start to look at those people in a different way. So just by that simple act of morality already has very powerful effect on us. So this is what we mean by positive conditioning. Now you are going against the grain, against the old conditioning, trying to do better than what you did before. Then there's the whole conditioning that I was talking about before today, about, again, overcoming anger, overcoming all these negative thoughts that we have sometimes. By being compassionate, by learning to look at people in a different way, understanding that they're conditional, all these kind of things. And just by looking at people in a new way, and it doesn't take that much, it's something everybody can do. You may think that getting rid of your anger is almost impossible, but it isn't. It actually isn't that hard to do if you go about it in a wise and skillful way, using some of those skillful means I was talking about earlier today. So learn to look at people differently, even the most difficult people. They also are a process of conditioning here. They are trapped in their own personality. We're all trapped in our own personalities. Can you step outside of your personality for a second? Can you? Anyone here who can step outside of their personality just a little bit? Well, maybe, I don't know, maybe if you have some very severe psychological disorder, you can do that. But for the majority of people, can't do that, you can't step outside. This is your personality, this is who you are. And sometimes we are proud of our personality, we certainly identify with it, that's the whole purpose of personality. But you can't step out of that, so we are prisoners of our personalities. This is what it means to be conditioned. The thing that you are, the thing that you feel right now, this is that conditioned process. So you learn to steer your personality in a different direction. You are creating yourself anew, by creating a more beautiful me, essentially. That's what you're doing. And what a wonderful thing that is. One of the problems with being a human being is that we have to have a sense of identity. Identity is very much part of what it is to be a person. You can't avoid that. It's part of having a sense of self. But if we're going to have a sense of identity, for goodness sake, let's make it a good identity. Let's move it in the right direction. You know that sometimes you feel you have a bad day or you have a good day. Which identity you want to have? You want to have the one on the good days. So let's make more of those good days. And when we make more of those good days, make even better ones, and build it up like that. And this is how you gradually change your conditioning, you change your mind states in this way. Coming on a meditation retreat, of course, is also part of that. It's a wonderful thing when you see that change inside of you. It's so beautiful. Happens over long periods of time, gradually. It is the only thing in the end that is really worthwhile investing in this life. Sure, you have to look after your family, you have to make an income by working, but make sure that how you do those things is the most important thing. Do it with care, do it with kindness, do it with compassion, and then you will grow spiritually at the same time as you are doing the duties you have to do in the world. Is that enough detail? More detail? These are the most important mind states to get rid of, the anger, negativity, that kind of stuff. And desire is a much more profound, difficult thing to get rid of, but that too can be reduced by thinking about the world in the right way. I'm not going to talk so much about this on this retreat, because this retreat is so short. Some people say too short, but at least 2 days, so we have to kind of focus on certain things, otherwise it gets too much. Anyway, next one. Okay, I've got to go a bit faster here, so What advice can you offer to those with strong emotions and anxiety in the body and the mind? My body wants to contort and contract due to many traumas. How can I help this process in meditation? Okay, so the most important thing is often to just to allow the body to be, allow the body to contort, allow it to contract. Don't try to control the body. Sometimes the traumas express themselves physically, and by allowing the body to move, you're actually allowing those traumas also to express themselves and deplete themselves of energy, if you like. And often the anxiety can disappear in that way. There are many examples of that. People go on meditation retreat, they really learn to relax, they might get into a deep meditation. They have some strange physical symptoms, yeah, some burning somewhere, something like that. And after the meditation, it's all gone, disappeared. And some kind of thing that they had from the past is gone because of the energy behind it, if you like, has disappeared. So allow things to be, yeah, don't try to control them. If you have anxiety, allow the anxiety to just be there. If you have other strong emotions, don't control them. And sometimes when we allow these things to be, they kind of almost disappear. If you try to hold them in check, it's almost as if they're pushing against you, yeah? So it feels like they're very powerful, very forceful there, because they're pushing against your control. And that is when you never actually get rid of those emotions. You never get rid of those traumas. So do that, and if there are specific trauma refers to specific people, it is very useful when you have a bit of time coming to a retreat like this to try to forgive them a little bit, yeah, to let go a little bit of that past. Very often people who oppress and abuse others often are people who inside of themselves already are very traumatized. Already have a great difficulty. Nobody in their right mind would really want to traumatize somebody else. So remember that. If somebody has traumatized you, very often it's because of their own pain inside, their own problems inside. So once you see that, easier to forgive. Yeah. So try to forgive a little bit, and also just be peaceful with yourself. Be kind to yourself. Forgive others. These things are two sides of the same coin almost. When you forgive others, you can forgive yourself. When you forgive yourself, you can forgive others. Because it is like almost like a holistic thing. You just forgive generally, and everybody gets forgiven as a consequence. Sometimes you can even focus on particular areas of the body and just kind of be kind to those particular areas. Have a sense of metta towards certain areas of yourself. If there are particular places that are painful or difficult, and then almost like you're massaging yourself in a sense with kindness, and then allow things to go that way. But be patient. Many of these things, they come and go a little bit. Maybe when you go on a retreat, if you do it skillfully, it reduces a little bit, and then you go back and it comes back a little bit again. Many of these things, they kind of gradual decline over a long period of time. But if you live skillfully, if you live well, they will gradually disappear. That is just the nature of these things. Okay, so it's not there. There are no kind of magic bullets with this. Yeah, you just have to kind of keep going, and hopefully, one of these days you'll get there. Okay, dear Venerable Ajahn Ramali, could you kindly give me some suggestion on how to deal with grief? As a very good friend of mine is sick in hospital. A wonderful retreat. Thank you. Suggestions on how to deal with grief. A very good friend is sick in hospital. The basic Buddhist idea of dealing with grief, the basic thing is always to be prepared beforehand. Yeah, to have the understanding that this is the nature of life. People get sick, people get old, people die. It has to be like that. And the more that kind of sinks in, the easier it is to deal with it when it actually happens. This is the nature of things. Why? You know, there's nothing really to grieve about. One of the most important things, of course, is that when somebody is very dear to you, like a very close friend, I have a couple of family members who have fairly at least one with quite advanced cancer and that sort of, and you know, also quite problematic in many ways. But of course, one of the best ways of dealing with that is also to remember that what matters in life is how we live. If somebody is a dear friend, it's probably because they are a good person. Otherwise, they wouldn't be a dear friend. Yeah? So obviously, they must have many good qualities. Because they have many good qualities, say, well, you are sick, but you don't have nothing to worry about. You may be sick. Okay, maybe things are going a bit down right now. Maybe you might even die from this illness. But with all the goodness that you have done in your life, nothing much to fear. You can die with a kind of in a wholesome way, in a good state of mind, and no problems. And I always tell when I went to, I remember going to hospital with Ajahn Brahm once. Ajahn Brahm is one of these kind of extraordinary people. He can say things that nobody else can say sometimes. Yeah, he can say things that other people would say, and you would be aghast. How can anybody say such a thing? But Ajahn Brahm can say those things, and people say, oh yeah, that's really wise, because he says it. And it is really wise, that's the thing, yeah? Because you're coming from the right place. So I went with Ajahn Brahm to hospital, and there was this young woman. She was in her 20s, and she was dying of cancer. And her family was there, yeah? But she was a little bit Buddhist. She was ready to hear things from the Buddhist point of view, So she was lying there, her family was around. Ajahn Brahm says, yay, hooray, you are dying. Look at this body is on the way out. There's nothing more to be had from this body is terrible. It's just a burden on you. Now you're going to be liberated from this body. It will feel so beautiful when you're liberated from this body. You will feel so light, you will feel so wonderful. Enjoy the dying process. Right? So he was like really upbeat. He was really happy. He was saying, finally you get rid of this body, yeah? And you can move on into something else. And this is like going with Ajahn Brahm to hospital and everybody around there kind of nodding sagely, yeah? And saying, yeah, that's right. And afterwards, she wasn't upset. She was really uplifted by his message. And not so long after he had left, of course, then she passed away and kind of moved on with that. So this is the right attitude, yeah? You go to hospital, you tell the people who are close to you, you have lived well. You have nothing to fear. Okay, death is part of life. You can't avoid that anyway. So you're gonna have to accept these things. Sickness is part of life. You've lived well. I allow you to let go. Please, whenever you're ready, please depart from here. That's another famous story that Ajahn Brahm tells. It's a story of a monk who was very sick. This was in one of the monasteries in England. And he was very sick, and he kind of verging, almost dying, you know, over a long period of time, over many weeks. But he couldn't, you know, neither could he die, nor could he really be well. He was kind of in between, yeah? He never really got well. He was just lying in bed all the time. Nothing really happened. I'm not exactly sure what kind of illness it was. Perhaps some virus he had contracted in Asia or something like that. But one day, the turning point was when the abbot of the monastery went up to him and said to him, it's okay, we allow you to die. Yeah. And the reason why he hadn't been able to get better, hadn't been able to get die, was he was feeling guilty about being sick. He was feeling bad about dying, about letting down his companions. But when they said, okay, we allow you to die, it's no problem. You know, it's okay, it's no issue. Then he kind of relaxed. And when he relaxed, he actually started to recover rather than dying instead. So we have to allow people to die. We have to allow people to pass away. And encourage them in a positive way by reminding them of the good things in life, the good things they have done. And that is a wonderful encouragement for people. And then they can hopefully die with peace in their heart and they can move on in a skillful way because we are helping them in that sense. And so that is one way. So, you know, very often if we get too concerned about some people dying, very often it's because our sense of loss. It's almost like slightly egocentric when we feel sad about somebody else's dying. But, you know, instead of thinking about ourselves, think about the other person. Encourage them. And then the whole thing seems far less sad because of that. And also, of course, one of the Buddhist ideas is that when we die, you move on to a next life in the future. When you move on into a next life in the future, then you may very likely see these people again. Yeah, so you get a bit of a holiday apart, and then you meet up again in the future. Yeah. Absence makes the heart grow fonder, right? So, okay, next one. Okay, doesn't everyone have delusions in some way? How do you know your view of reality is okay here? Doesn't everyone have delusions in some way? I think that is probably true here. But the point is here that there are certain specific delusions that we are talking about. And this is really the point. I mean, even the Buddha, if you had asked him about what would happen in 2,500 years' time, he probably wouldn't be able to tell you, in detail. So it's not as if we know everything in the right way here. The point rather is that there are certain things that you can grasp with insight according to the Buddhist teachings. And that is what this is all about. And what it really is about is the nature of what it is to be a human being or to be any kind of being. What is the nature of our mind? Is there a self here? Are we some kind of permanent entity? When you die, what's going to happen? Are you going to last forever? Are you going to go to heaven? Are you just going to disappear and there will be nothing? Are you going to be reborn somewhere perhaps and continue on? What's actually going to happen when you die? These kind of big questions about the nature of the mind, who we really are. And from that, the most important thing is to understand the distinction between happiness and suffering. That is part and parcel of that as well. The thing that the Buddha did when he went forth from the home life into homelessness, what he was actually doing was seeking a solution to the problems of life. Where is real happiness? Where is real suffering? And what he claimed to have found was the answer to that question. Where real happiness is to be found, where suffering is to be found. And when you think about it, that's what everyone wants. This is actually the answer to the question of the meaning of life. Everybody wants to find happiness. Everybody wants to find an end to problems. Almost everything we do in our lives is a movement away from problems and a movement towards some kind of solution. Everything is about that. When you start to think about your day, almost everything you do has some kind of purpose in that area. And the Buddha promises us that he has found the final solution to this happiness and suffering thing here. So that's why I say that the Buddhist teachings, as far as I'm concerned, they are the answer to the question of the meaning of life. And if something is the answer to the question of meaning of life, then what are you going to do except to dedicate yourself to that practice? What else are you going to do? If this is the answer to what life is all about, that's what you have to do. And that's how it seems to me. And because it seems that way to me, this is one of the reasons why I've been living the life of a monastic for over 20 years. Because it seems, tomorrow I might say, oh, it's all rubbish. But that's how it seems now, uncertain. So these teachings are very, to me, extraordinarily powerful because they actually go to the core, to the essence of what it is to be a human being, any being at all. And that is the delusion that we are talking about. And that is the reality here. That is the claim of the Buddha anyway. Of course, you read the suttas and you may dispute that, you may disagree or whatever. That's the claim that he is making. And in my estimation, it seems to be right. Okay. The next one. Can you tell us about correlation between thought, feeling and emotions? At what point does it manifest into action? Correlation between thoughts, feelings and emotions, at what point does it manifest in action? Okay, well, one of the things about the suttas, these, of course, thoughts, feelings and emotions, these are very closely related to each other. Feelings, just very briefly, feeling in Buddhism is not what we mean by feeling usually in the English language. English feeling means like emotion, It's very almost exactly the same word. Feelings in Buddhism, the Pali word is vedana. Vedana means the whether an experience is positive, negative or neutral. So the whole world, everything you experience can be divided into whether it's pleasant, unpleasant or neutral. And of course, emotions are like that. So emotions also have that aspect to them. Thoughts have that aspect to them. So all of these things are interlinked in that way. If you think in the right way, you will have positive emotions and feelings as a result. Think in the wrong way, and you will have bad emotions and feelings as a result. So how we think is actually very important. And one of the interesting teachings that the Buddha teaches is the teaching about what is known as the vipalasa. Vipalasa means like the distortions of the mind. And the Buddha makes a connection between perception, thoughts, and outlook or views. Yeah, and this is a kind of a perhaps more interesting, to me, more interesting connection than, it also connects with this, of course, but it's more easy perhaps to understand how it all works by looking at that. So we have views about things, yeah? We look at the world in a certain way. In other words, like I've been talking about before, about our values and outlook, what matters to us. We have views about those things. Because we have views about the world, that makes, that influences, that has an effect on how we perceive things. We perceive things according to our views. Yeah, so when we look at the world in a certain way, if, for example, we have a certain person who is our enemy, when we see that person, the perception enemy arises in our mind. The view influences the perception. And then when the perception has arisen, that influences our thoughts. So we think of that person as an enemy, or a friend, if it happens to be a friend. I don't know why I always take the negative side of things. It's a bad habit of mind. Change that habit. So if you see a friend, you think about the friend, if you're really happy about that. And then because you think of them as a friend, that reinforces the view that they are a friend. So this is why you have this loop that goes around and around and around. Views, perception, thoughts, and it reinforces each other. And it's very hard to get out of those traps. And that's why breaking habits can be so difficult. Yeah? And of course, once you have those, once you are trapped in that sort of a circle, then of course you act accordingly. You act towards them as if they are a friend or an enemy or whatever it is. And then you reap the results in terms of feelings and emotions and all these things. But learning to use our mind wisely is the way out of this. Learning, deliberately trying to think differently. And if you think differently, that will influence your emotions. So how can you think differently? Yeah, it's always nice to do this on a retreat like this. Here you are, you have a bit of spare time, you are away from your ordinary life. And because you are away, you have a bit more perspective. Yeah, so because you have more perspective, you can think, okay, now I really don't like this person. Now how can I think about this person in a different way? What is the redeeming kind of features of this person? So I can see them in a positive light instead. Now is a good opportunity to do that. Yeah, so you do that. And then when you change your thinking mind, it starts to affect your feelings. You feel different about that person. So this is how these things operate together. At least one way they operate together. I'm sure there are many other ways. And if you can think them out, please let me know. Dear Ajahn, how can I change my own conditioning? Okay, we have talked about that already, right? I have already said quite a bit about that. So you just have to, now you have to put it into practice. Yeah, and this is why I read out these suttas every year, because you forget. Yeah, sometimes people feel, oh no, not that sutta again. But I actually enjoy reading the sutta every year, many times a year. I like it because it conditions me as well. It allows me to remind, it reminds me of what I have to do. So hopefully you feel the same way. Because by that repetition, yeah, that's how real brainwashing works. You repeat it ad nauseam. Yeah? Keep on listening to these things. Come again and again. Listen to the same sutta. I promise I will do the same sutta again on the next retreat, right? And then you will gradually get a condition and you will hear these things and then you slowly get there. Keep on listening to the Dhamma. Keep on reading the word of the Buddha. Keep on hanging out with good people, like-minded people who think a bit like you, who also want to be kind and compassionate. And gradually, we all condition in the right direction here. Okay, I can read without glasses. That's a miracle here. Can a person change one's inherent nature with practice? Can a person change one's inherent nature with practice? Okay, so the problem with a question like this is a question that it has assumptions built into the question. And if those assumptions are wrong, then there is no answer to the question. The assumption here is that you have an inherent nature, yeah? That's the assumption of this question. Can you change your inherent nature? If you really had an inherent nature, of course you couldn't change it because it was inherent. That's the meaning of inherent. It's always there. It is unchangeable. It is your essence is who you really are. So inherent nature cannot change, but your conditioned nature can change. And the Buddha says our nature is conditioned. For that reason, you can't change it. So it's just the problem is just the habits. Yeah, maybe that's what you mean. I'm sure you didn't mean inherent nature because you probably knew that already. But maybe you mean your strong habits, and yes, they can be changed. You just have to be persistent with it, and gradually they will change. What can one do once we recognize our nature to accept ourselves? Well, again, it is remembering that you are conditioned, yeah? Remembering that some of that condition comes from deep, deep into the past, from a Buddhist point of view, can come from past lives. So because of that, you realize that there is nothing you can do right here, right now, to change who you are. It's going to have to be a slow thing here, because the conditioning is so deep. It goes very deeply. You're like a steam, you're like this train, right? This enormous train, like this bauxite, Alcoa bauxite train running down on the flatlands just below here. They come every few hours, a massive bauxite train coming through. And when that bauxite train is in motion, it takes a long time to stop because there's thousands of tons of bauxite on these trains. So we are like bauxite trains. Yeah, your mind is full of bauxite. The bauxite is all the conditioning from the past. Can you feel the weight of the bauxite in your mind? Yeah, the bauxite is all the conditioning, all the habits, and it has a lot of momentum from the past. And just like the train takes a long way to turn over, an exact turn around and stop, in exactly the same way, it takes a long time to retrain the mind to turn in a different direction. But eventually, you turn all the way around into 180 degrees different direction, and you think about things completely differently from what you did before. That should never discourage you. All it should do is just remind you to be compassionate towards yourself when you do this practice. Yeah? Gradually, 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 things will change. Okay. Are the pleasures of life not amplified when shared? If so, why are monks so solitary? Okay, are the pleasures of life amplified when shared? Why are monks so solitary? Actually, the pleasures of life are amplified when you are by yourself. You know, it's actually the other way around. And this is what meditation teaches you after a while. Why do you come? If sharing was all there was to pleasure, you would just stay in Perth. You would just go to the cafes and drink coffee all day, yeah? Hanging out with people all the time. But after a while, you get fed up with that. After a while, you have nothing more to talk about anyway, except for all the politics in the world, all that kind of stuff, and that lets you down anyway. After a while, you just want to come out into the bush, be by yourself, see the kangaroos, see the monks, yeah? See your fellow practitioners, because you want to be by yourself. Solitariness has a lot to be said for it. Real happiness, according to the Buddhist teachings, happens in solitude when you are by yourself. You need to withdraw from the world in order to achieve real depth of meditation practice. Yeah, and then, once you have achieved that, yes, then you can go back out again. And you can share it with others, but you share it through your teachings, through telling about how to achieve these things. That's how you share that. But if you look at somebody like Ajahn Brahm is, you know, he's one of the great meditation masters of the modern era. You know, by international standards, he's kind of really astonishing meditation practice. And if you see Ajahn Brahm, he never hangs around. He always kind of, some of you have been coming to Bodhinyana Monastery, right? And there's a clock on the wall over there. And when kind of he feels that the visitor has been there a bit long, he starts looking at the clock like this. And the visitor quickly sees that he's looking at the clock. Oh, okay, I better go now. This is one of the tricks of Ajahn Brahm, to kind of hint, okay, now time is up. And people usually get it very quickly. So Ajahn Brahm's trick is always to get back to his kuti as quickly as possible. He wants to help people, but he doesn't want to just hang around if unnecessary. So don't feel offended if Ajahn Brahm looks at the clock, because he does that with everyone. So he just looks up. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. So it's just his way of saying that I want to go back and be by myself. So solitariness has a lot to be said for it. Yes, you can share a lot with other people. Some degree of being around others is good. You have to wait till you are ready for being solitary. If you're not ready, you're going to go nuts. Yeah. go into the forest by yourself, stay there for a fortnight, and you come out wide-eyed afterwards and really out of your mind. So you have to know the right time for these things as well. And this is one of the things the Buddha tells you in the suttas, is when the right time is to actually go into solitude. A little bit of solitude, everyone can take it, but lots of solitude is much more difficult to take. There are some monks who live, not in our monastery, but in monasteries in like in Sri Lanka, where there's still a lot of jungle. They live in the middle of the jungle. Don't talk to anyone. And to do that kind of stuff, you really have to have your act together. Okay. What, according to you, is the purpose of life? Okay. According to me, purpose of life is coming to Dana Grove, hanging out, chilling, enjoying yourself. That's the purpose of life. Purpose of life is just to move towards happiness. Yeah? As long as you feel that you are moving in a good direction, that the good qualities in you are improving, the bad qualities are declining, you are fulfilling the purpose of life. This is the Buddha said, the only thing you need to be concerned about in your life is just that much. Are you improving in kindness, in mindfulness, in stillness, in compassion, in love, in all of these good qualities? Are you declining in anger, irritation, greed, delusion, confusion? If you are, then you are on the right track. That is the purpose of life, and then you are fulfilling it. And you are moving towards something really exciting. Yeah, it is really exciting, because you don't really know where this is going to end. If you keep on developing your good qualities, and you keep on dropping away the bad ones, where is that going to end? And this is kind of the exciting thing about this journey here. Because you can build this up a long, long, long way. And the Buddha promises us, as I said before, if you keep on building it up, eventually you achieve the ending of all problems, all suffering, and you achieve the highest happiness that is possible. That is the promise of the Buddha. Yeah? And of course, because everybody wants that, everybody wants to be happy, yeah? That must be the purpose of life. So keep on doing the right thing, keep on living in the right way, and you will feel incredibly fulfilled. This is one of the great things about being a monk, isn't it? Or a nun, or even a layperson who practices some kind of spiritual teaching. You feel a sense of fulfillment. Life has a purpose. Yeah, if you just live for worldly pleasures, then life is kind of purposeless. You come to the end of your life, imagine that all you have done is living for worldly pleasures, building up, you have maybe a nice house, you have a big bank account, you have a good family, you have good business connections, right? And everything is kind of going really well, and everything is fine. And then suddenly you got told you have cancer, or you're just getting old and you're dying. And then you realize that everything you have done in this world, you have to let it go. You can't take it with you. You have focused all your energy on stuff that you have to leave behind. If you do that, then on your deathbed, you start to feel confused, you feel uncertain, you feel like you have wasted your time. You feel like I had this opportunity to live my life well, to build up a mind that I could also take with me into the future after I die. But I haven't done that. All I have done is do things that belong to this life that now I have to leave behind. I can't take it with me. When you die like that, it's not a happy death. So make sure that in this life, and this is why ideas like rebirth are so important from a Buddhist point of view, make sure that in this life you do things and you build up a mind that you can actually bring with you into the future after this life is finished. Those are the qualities that really matter, because those are the things that will be there for you in the long term. Yeah. Then you feel that you are fulfilling the meaning of life, because you are literally investing in the right place. Yeah, forget about the stock market. Go for the, I don't know, the internal market. I'm not sure what it's called. Purpose, the meaning of life. It's not that hard to understand. Yeah, all you have to do is look inside of yourself. What do you really want? It's pretty obvious. We all want to be happy. We want to be free of suffering. We don't want to have depression, sadness, sorrows. We'd have right to have more joy and happiness in our lives. I think that's pretty bleeding obvious, yeah? So that is what we should go for here. Yeah. Okay. A few more questions. I shall do them all, because there aren't that many. So we shall have to get through all of them here. Yeah. Thank you for your teaching, Ajahn Brahmali. Often when I meditate, I get an involuntary smile. Whoa, that's really good. Involuntary smile are the best smiles, yeah? These are the really good ones. Come across my face, and I feel happiness. Yay! It doesn't say that here. I added that. It only lasts for 15 to 20 minutes. That's pretty good already. Then it goes away. My mind isn't always completely still when this happens, though. So I'm not sure if it is part of the process described in the suttas we are looking at with metta. Wow, that's wonderful. If you get an involuntary smile, these are the best kind of smiles, because it means you're not forcing it. A lot of the time we have to force smiles, yeah? Because we have to be friendly with the people around us. But the involuntary smile that come from inside, that are genuine, these are the really good ones. You just sit there, you just feel happy, and you just kind of smile because it just feels so natural to do that. So, and sometimes you can even, you can smile a little bit on purpose, a little bit forcefully, just to kind of feel good. It makes you feel naturally good when you smile because it reminds you of positive feelings. So that's great. That's wonderful. You should be very happy about that. Only 15, 20 minutes. Never think only 15, 20 minutes is wonderful. 5 minutes is great. 2 hours is great. Anything is great, yeah? There's no such thing as only. What matters is that you are doing well and you are enjoying yourself. That is the most important thing here. So just keep on doing that, and if you keep on doing that, keep on practicing in the right way. Never think about the results in a meditation practice. If you start thinking about the results, usually the meditation goes down the toilet. So that's the wrong place for the meditation. So you don't think about the results, because that gives rise to craving and desire, and you're always kind of on the outlook. Now it's coming, it's happening now. And as soon as you think, now it's happening, it's destroyed already. So look at the causes. What are the causes? Gentleness, kindness, yeah? These things. Look at that. Peacefulness. Then the results will happen as a matter of course. Forget about the results. The more you can forget about the results, the more they tend to happen naturally as a matter of course. Yeah? So that's a very good habit to get into. Just to enjoy every meditation, regardless of how bad and how terrible it is. Look for the little happinesses that are there. Usually every meditation has a bit of happiness. Every meditation is slightly different, but there's always something positive that comes out of them if you look in the right place. Okay, how do you reassure happiness? Is it possible to not realize one is happy? That's an interesting one. Is it possible to realize it? Like running around, hooray, yay, are you happy? No. I'm not sure how that would work, but I think usually if you are happy, you probably maybe don't think about it, but if somebody asks you, you probably know, right? It's like the arahant, the fully awakened person. If they don't go around thinking all the time, I'm awakened, but if you ask them, they know that they are awakened. Same kind of thing here. How do you reassure happiness? Yeah, the only way to reassure happiness is to practice the Buddhist path all the way to the end. There is no other way. Otherwise, you will go up, you might get a bit of happiness in this life, and it goes down again, up again, down again, up again. Yeah, you go through the cycles of ups and downs. The only way to reassure it is to practice the path all the way to its end. That's the only promise where happiness is reassured and there is no more problems. And yes, then you realize that you are happy. Yeah, you realize that you have ended all suffering. This is another way of saying happiness. If you have any doubts that whether you are an arahant, if you think, maybe I'm an arahant, maybe not, you're not an arahant. you're not enlightened if you have doubts about it. Okay. Can we reach samadhi and lose it? Yes, it's possible to reach samadhi and lose it. Samadhi is a deep meditation. Pal is a word from the ancient Indian languages. It means deep meditation. That's really what it means. And samadhi, you can have it for a while. And then if you stop practicing, you stop putting in the causes, as I was just saying, the samadhi can fade away. You sit down and meditate, and you spend the rest of your life craving to re-achieve that samadhi. So instead of having samadhi, you have craving for samadhi. Now, craving for samadhi is painful, samadhi is delightful. So make sure you don't do that, make that mistake. It's very easy to make. Yeah. So again, the way to avoid that is to just to put in the causes. Keep putting in the causes again and again and again. Do the right thing. Don't worry about the results. And that is the way to ensure stability of samadhi in your life. I mean, even if you can get into some samadhi, it's astonishing. It's amazing. You should be so happy if you get a little bit of samadhi on a retreat like this. Yeah, what a wonderful thing that is. Because already, if you get some samadhi, you're already kind of doing really well on the Buddhist path, heading towards, you know, the deeper states of the anapanasati and all these kind of things. It's absolutely marvelous if that happens. But don't attach to it. Okay. Do we have to progress gradually from breath to feeling to impermanence? Do you have to progress gradually? Yes, it has to be gradual. If you try to go too fast, this is the history of Buddhism, it's the history of trying to do things faster. That's the history of Buddhism. You know what I mean? So you have the Theravada, or the original teaching of the Buddha, and then they say, no, this is not good enough. We want to kind of do better. Everyone should become Buddhas, so everyone should be Bodhisattvas. So then you start the Bodhisattva path. And then later on, no, that's not fast enough. We have to have special practices, yeah, that kind of bypass the whole Noble Eightfold Path, that take you to awakening much, much quicker. So it's like the third turning of the wheel or whatever. Every time the idea is to make things faster. Yeah. But I think that is one of the big mistakes in faults, that we always want to do things more quickly. Because by doing things more quickly, by trying to take the shortcut, we end up with a long cut instead. Yeah, there is no shortcut. There is the Noble Eightfold Path. If there really was a shortcut, the Buddha would have taught it. There's no point in teaching a long cut when there is a shortcut. Yeah, so you stay with the shortcut is actually the Noble Eightfold Path. So be skeptical. I'm always skeptical when I hear, oh, this is the quick route, yeah, this is the fast one. Why are you guys messing around with the Eightfold Path when I have this super-duper highway over here? Come on my highway. And I always find that very, very concerning when I hear that kind of thing. I just don't believe it. One of the assumptions of Buddhism, one of the basic assumptions, is that the Buddha knew what he was talking about. The Buddha, the whole idea of Buddhism is that there was some person in history who had a profound insight into reality. Yeah, that's the whole purpose, whole point of it. So if the Buddha had that insight, he had it, and then Buddhism is founded on something true. If it didn't have it, and others had a deeper insight, then you may question the entire foundation of Buddhism. So be suspicious when you hear about shortcuts. I don't really believe in shortcuts. Eightfold Path. Okay, a couple more questions for tonight. Can you speak about the struggle the ego has of letting go, of fighting the process of striving here? Okay, the struggle the ego has of letting go, of fighting the process of striving here. This is one of the biggest problems in meditation practice. Just having that ability to sit back and be aware and allow things to be and not struggle too much. This is one of those things that we need to learn in meditation. And it's a very beautiful thing to learn, because you feel very peaceful when you stop striving. When you're just aware, there's a beautiful peace about that. So notice that peace when it happens, because it encourages you in the right direction. How do you do that? Well, a big important part of that is precisely to notice the happiness that comes when the struggle dies down. If you see the happiness of that, you won't struggle so much anymore, because you understand that the will is a bit like a tyrant that creates problems for you. Yeah? Do you want to be with tyrants, or do you mean with a kind of a nice mind who doesn't tyrannize you? So you withdraw a little bit from that by seeing the happiness that comes from letting go of that struggle all the time. This is a very important part of the small little insight that we build up as part of our Buddhist practice. Again, this is what you do at the end of the meditation. You ask yourself, what did I do this time? What happened? Where does this happiness come from that I've been experiencing? And one of the things that you notice is that because the will is dying down, you actually feel better. It's one of the things you notice. Yeah, and when you see that, it's easier next time to let go of that will. So this is one of the ways of doing that. So a lot of it is just learning to sit back and just learning to observe, allowing things to become peaceful. One of the ways you can do that, if you'd like to meditate at home, is to get a nice guided meditation, maybe some teacher who you have as your favorite teacher, and just put that on to get you into the right mood. Very often getting into the right mood can be the hardest part, especially when you meditate at home. So put that on to help you to get you into a peaceful mood. Yeah, some people, they have a natural feeling about them which makes you peaceful. This, who that person is, will vary depending on your personal qualities. And listen to that, and then things start to become calm as a consequence. How to use little tricks like that. Then gradually you're heading in the right direction. A lot of the restlessness comes because we haven't got enough happiness in our life yet. So you sit down, you think about things. Somebody told me today about doing this sport, right? And this sport is so good, apparently. It's this really, really good sport. And well, I didn't say what it was. I'm not sure. They didn't tell me what it was, but it was a really, really good sport. And so when he sits down in meditation, he thinks about the sport all the time. Not all the time, perhaps, but a lot of the time. I like to exaggerate a bit for effect, right? So please forgive me for that. So he thinks about the sport. The problem there is that you are finding happiness in that sport. You're finding happiness and fantasizing about, how you're going to do this in the future or whatever. And the problem there is that you're not yet having enough happiness in your meditation practice. This is one of those very important things, to move away from the thinking and restless mind, is actually to find the happiness in the spiritual path instead. And you do that by gradually living in the right way, by integrating all the factors on the spiritual path. It's a complete path with 8 factors. Not enough just to do meditation. Do all 8 factors together. That's 9. That's 1 too many. 8 factors. Do them all together. Then it starts to work and come together. And then be patient. Allow things to work. Give yourself weeks, months, sometimes years, and things come together gradually. Yeah, the thinking mind is less interesting if you have something more happy to be aware of. This is really the trick of meditation. This is why happiness is so important. This is really allows the mind to become very peaceful because you have something better. Why do you want to think about something silly? Yeah, if you have something very beautiful already. Make the present moment the pleasant moment. Okay, 2 more questions. For tonight. So, dear Ajahn, does it mean that one will not experience animitta if they meditate with their eyes partly closed? No, I think the best thing is the ideal way to meditate is with your eyes closed, yeah? Because you want to reduce the sensory input of the world outside you. I would recommend you to have your eyes closed. But if you feel that you want to start off with your eyes half closed, perhaps to kind of settle down a little bit first and a little bit more later on, you can do that as a kind of intermediate step. That's okay. Or perhaps you are afraid of falling asleep or whatever, but don't be afraid of that. It's okay to fall asleep. If you start snoring in here, we will all forgive you for that. It's quite nice when somebody snores. I think it's quite cool because if somebody snores, they're really relaxed, really unselfconscious. I really admire that. People can be so unselfconscious, just snore away, and everybody's kind of looking a little bit kind of over at you. It's a wonderful thing. It means you're really relaxing, and that's a positive thing. So I try, when I hear somebody snoring, I try to have a sense of mudita, a sense of appreciative joy when somebody snores in the audience. It doesn't make any sense to get irritated about that. It's just people relaxing, and that's a good thing. So that's okay. So have your eyes half closed if you like. But there comes a time when you want to shut out all the sensory experience because sensory experience is inherently disturbing. especially the eyes, because the eyes draw in so much information. They say that, I think they say something like 80% of the sensory input comes through the eyes. The eyes are just very dominant in our sensory world. So by closing your eyes, you're actually closing off a lot of disturbance right there. So I would recommend that. But again, it is individual. It depends where, how your meditation is going. Yeah, it depends on your mind state. It depends on all of these things. So don't follow me like some slave and do exactly what I say. Think for yourself what works for you. That is, of course, so important. Eventually, especially when you want to get to the nimitta stages, there's no way that you would even want to have your eyes open anymore. Absolutely no way, because it's just painful to have your eyes open. You want to be just within yourself. You don't want to have anything to do with the senses. You want to shut all that out, because it's just a nuisance. Because the inner experience is so beautiful, so powerful, so wonderful. Why on earth would you want to see anything at that point? So you just withdraw inside of yourself, close your eyes, and you feel so content and happy with what you have. Okay. Last question for tonight. Dear Ajahn, I find each day of my practice is different. That is exactly right. That's what I think most people find. That's good. There are days I experience rapture, joy, etc. But some other days, it's not the same. Yeah, this is kind of what you can expect. That some days it will come, because some days the conditioning is just right. Yeah, the company is right. The atmosphere is right. You're remembering something good. All the conditions come together and you feel joy. Another day, the conditions don't come together. The bad conditions come together. And you may feel a bit negative even, or whatever it is. How do I find out the progress of my practice? Thank you. So the progress is to look big picture. Yeah, don't look from day to day. Don't even look from week to week. Look every time you come here to this meditation center and you go on a retreat and see what is happening to you from 1 year to the next one, or from 6 months to the next 6 months. That's almost the kind of time scale you need. Yeah, and if you see that within the scope of a few months, 6 months maybe, you see that you are more mindful, you have more awareness, you have more time for other people, you are more gentle, you are more kind, you are more compassionate, you have less anger problem, you have less desires, these things are dying down. If you see that is happening over long time scales, then you know you're heading in the right direction. If that is not happening, you have to ask yourself why. Yeah, if you're not making it, some people say, oh, I'm not making any progress. I've been doing this for so long. You have to ask yourself why. And sometimes we have to be brutally honest with ourselves to be able to see our shortcomings. If you don't have that willingness to really be honest with yourself, then sometimes you're going to shut out those negative qualities in yourself that you don't want to see. But you have to see those, because the only way you're going to be able to overcome them is to accept them in the first place. So accept yourself for who you are. Accept your whole person. Yeah, everything. You are okay. It's okay to have flaws. Everybody has flaws. Yeah, and what a wonderful thing that is. And it's no problem at all. And then you have the opportunity of overcoming them, because you accept yourself for who you are in the first place. And then you have that honesty which is required on this path to move forward. There's a beautiful little verse in the Dhammapada. The Dhammapada is one of the most well-loved books in the whole Buddhist discourses. Dhammapada literally means verses on the Dhamma being the teaching of the Buddha. And this little verse says something to the effect that if somebody points out a flaw in your character, you should thank them for, as if they're pointing out a treasure to you. Yeah. Can you do that? If somebody says a flaw to your character, what happens? Do you say, oh, thank you so much, sadhu, sadhu, sadhu? Or do you say, go away, don't want to hear about it? Well, of course, it's complicated, right? It depends who the person is. It depends on the circumstances. It's complicated. Sometimes people say these things for completely the wrong reasons, and there's no good reason to listen to them. But sometimes if you have a good teacher who tells it to you in a kind-hearted way to help you out, it's a wonderful thing, because sometimes it allows you to go deeper in your meditation practice, to see something inside of yourself that you may not have seen before. Yeah, so it's like uncovering a treasure, because it allows you more happiness in your life. It allows you to move beyond suffering, and that's why it is like uncovering a treasure. In fact, it is the best treasure that you can possibly have if you can experience more real happiness and less real suffering in your life. Okay, so, and then it says, wish you a very happy birthday on the 27th of October. Thank you so much. That is very kind of you. May all your spiritual aspirations come true. Okay, sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. My wish to you for tomorrow. Okay, that's very, very kind of you. And that is all that, that's all the questions for tonight. And please continue the evening and do as you like, as you see fit, if you want to meditate more or whatever. Make sure that you just enjoy yourself. Have a good time. And we'll see you again tomorrow morning. Continue tomorrow morning.